I'm that myself, but I'm surprised at you, brother. Jump in, jump in. Let him pass, Ivan. It will be fun. He can lie somewhere at our feet. Will you lie at our feet, Fonson, or perch on the box with the coachman? Skip onto the box, Fonson. But Ivan, who had by now taken his seat, without a word gave Maximov a violent punch in the breast and sent him flying. It was quite by chance he did not fall. "Drive on!" Ivan shouted angrily to the coachman. "Why, what are you doing? What are you about? Why'd you do that?" Fyodor Pavlovich protested. But the carriage had already driven away. Ivan made no reply. "Well, you are a fella," Fyodor Pavlovich said again. After a pause of 2 minutes, looking askance at his son, "Why, it was you got up all this monastery business. You urged it. You approved of it. Why are you angry now?" "You've talked rot enough. You might rest a bit now," Ivan snapped sullenly. Fyodor Pavlovich was silent again for 2 minutes. "Drop of brandy, it'd be nice now," he observed sententiously, but Ivan made no response. "You shall have some, too, when we get home." Ivan was silent. Fyodor Pavlovich was silent again for 2 minutes. "But I shall take Alyosha away from the monastery, though you will dislike it so much, most honored Karl von Moor." Ivan shrugged his shoulders contemptuously and, turning away, stared at the road, and they did not speak again all the way home. Part 1, Book 3, The Sensualists. Chapter 1, In the Servants' Quarters. The Karamazovs' house was far from being in the centre of the town, but it was not quite outside it. It was a pleasant-looking old house of 2 stories, painted grey, with a red iron roof. It was roomy and snug, and might still last many years. There were all sorts of unexpected little cupboards and closets and staircases. There were rats in it, but Fyodor Pavlovich did not altogether dislike them. "One doesn't feel so solitary when one's left alone in the evening," he used to say. It was his habit to send the servants away to the lodge for the night and to lock himself up alone. The lodge was a roomy and solid building in the yard. Fyodor Pavlovich used to have the cooking done there. Although there was a kitchen in the house, he did not like the smell of cooking, and winter and summer alike, the dishes were carried in across the courtyard. The house was built for a large family. There was room for 5 times as many, with their servants. But at the time of our story, there was no one living in the house but Fyodor Pavlovich and his son Ivan. And in the lodge there were only 3 servants, old Grigory and his old wife Marfa, and a young man called Smerdyakov. Of these 3 we must say a few words. Of old Grigory we have said something already. He was firm and determined, and went blindly and obstinately for his object. If once he had been brought by any reason, and they were often very illogical ones, to believe that it was immutably right. He was honest and incorruptible. His wife, Marfa Ignatyevna, had obeyed her husband's will implicitly all her life, yet she had pestered him terribly after the emancipation of the serfs. She was set on leaving Fyodor Pavlovich and opening a little shop in Moscow with their small savings. But Grigory decided then, once for all, that the woman's talking nonsense, for every woman is dishonest, and that they ought not to leave their old master, whatever he might be, for that was now their duty. "Do you understand what duty is?" he asked Marfa Ignatyevna. "I understand what duty means, Grigory Vasilievich, but why it's our duty to stay here I never shall understand," Marfa answered firmly. "Well, don't understand them, but so it shall be, and you hold your tongue." And so it was. They did not go away, and Fyodor Pavlovich promised them a small sum for wages, and paid it regularly. Grigory knew, too, that he had an indisputable influence over his master. It was true, and he was aware of it. Fyodor Pavlovich was an obstinate and cunning buffoon, yet, though his will was strong enough, in some of the affairs of life, as he expressed it, he found himself, to his surprise, extremely feeble in facing certain other emergencies. He knew his weaknesses and was afraid of them. There are positions in which one has to keep a sharp lookout, and that's not easy without a trustworthy man. And Gregory was a most trustworthy man. Many times in the course of his life, Fyodor Pavlovich had only just escaped a sound thrashing through Grigory's intervention, and on each occasion the old servant gave him a good lecture. But it wasn't only thrashings that Fyodor Pavlovich was afraid of. There were graver occasions, and very subtle and complicated ones, when Fyodor Pavlovich could not have explained the extraordinary craving for someone faithful and devoted, which sometimes unaccountably came upon him all in a moment. It was almost a morbid condition, corrupt and often cruel in his lust, like some noxious insect. Fyodor Pavlovich was sometimes, in moments of drunkenness, overcome by superstitious terror and a moral convulsion which took an almost physical form. "My soul simply quaking in my throat at those times," he used to say. At such moments he liked to feel that there was, near at hand, in the lodge, if not in the room, a strong, faithful man, virtuous, and, unlike himself, who had seen all his debauchery and knew all his secrets, but was ready in his devotion to overlook all that, not to oppose him above all, not to reproach him or threaten him with anything, either in this world or in the next, and, in case of need, to defend him. From whom? From somebody unknown, but terrible and dangerous. What he needed was to feel that there was another, a man, an old and tried friend, that he might call him in his sick moments merely to look at his face, or perhaps exchange some quite irrelevant words with him. And if the old servant were not angry, he felt comforted, and if he were angry, he was more dejected. It happened even, very rarely, however, that Fyodor Pavlovich went at night to the lodge to wake Grigory and fetch him for a moment. When the old man came, Fyodor Pavlovich would begin talking about the most trivial matters, and would soon let him go again, sometimes even with a jest. And after he'd gone, Fyodor Pavlovich would get into bed with a curse and sleep the sleep of the just. Something of the same sort had happened to Fyodor Pavlovich on Alyosha's arrival. Alyosha pierced his heart by living with him, seeing everything and blaming nothing. Moreover, Alyosha brought with him something his father had never known before, a complete absence of contempt for him, and an invariable kindness, a perfectly natural, unaffected devotion to the old man who deserved it so little. All this was a complete surprise to the old profligate, who had dropped all family ties. It was a new and surprising experience for him, who had till then loved nothing but evil. When Alyosha had left him, he confessed to himself that he'd learnt something he had not till then been willing to learn. I have mentioned already that Grigory had detested Adelaida Ivanovna, the first wife of Fyodor Pavlovich and the mother of Dmitri, and that he had, on the contrary, protected Sofia Ivanovna, the poor crazy woman, against his master and anyone who chanced to speak ill or lightly of her. His sympathy for the unhappy wife had become something sacred to him, so that even now, 20 years after, he could not bear a slighting allusion to her from anyone, and would at once check the offender. Externally, Grigory was cold, dignified, and taciturn, and spoke, weighing his words, without frivolity. It was impossible to tell at first sight whether he loved his meek, obedient wife, but he really did love her, and she knew it. Marfa Ignatyevna was by no means foolish. She was probably indeed cleverer than her husband, or at least more prudent than he in worldly affairs, and yet she had given in to him in everything, without question or complaint, ever since her marriage, and respected him for his spiritual superiority. It was remarkable how little they spoke to one another in the course of their lives, and only of the most necessary daily affairs. The grave and dignified Grigory thought over all his cares and duties alone, so that Marfa Ignatyevna had long grown used to knowing that he did not need her advice. She felt that her husband respected her silence and took it as a sign of her good sense. He had never beaten her but once, and then only slightly. Once, during the year after Fyodor Pavlovich's marriage with Adelaida Ivanovna, the village girls and women, at that time serfs, were called together before the house to sing and dance. They were beginning In the Green Meadows, when Marfa, at that time a young woman, skipped forward and danced the Russian dance, not in the village fashion, but as she had danced it when she was a servant in the service of the rich Miosov family in their private theatre, where the actors were taught to dance by a dancing master from Moscow. Grigory saw how his wife danced, and, an hour later at home in their cottage, he gave her a lesson, pulling her hair a little. But there it ended, the beating was never repeated, and Marfa Ignatyevna gave up dancing. God had not blessed them with children. One child was born, but it died. Grigory was fond of children, and was not ashamed of showing it. When Adelaida Ivanovna had run away, Grigory took Dmitri, then a child of 3 years old, combed his hair and washed him in a tub with his own hands, and looked after him for almost a year. Afterwards he'd looked after Ivan and Alyosha, for which the general's widow had rewarded him with a slap in the face. But I have already related all that. The only happiness his own child had brought him had been in the anticipation of its birth. When it was born he was overwhelmed with grief and horror. The baby had 6 fingers. Grigory was so crushed by this that he was not only silent till the day of the christening, but kept away in the garden. It was spring, and he spent 3 days digging the kitchen garden. The 3rd day was fixed for christening the boy. Meantime Grigory had reached a conclusion. Going into the cottage, where the clergy were assembled and the visitors had arrived, including Fyodor Pavlovich, who was to stand godfather, he suddenly announced that the baby ought not to be christened at all. He announced this quietly, briefly, forcing out his words and gazing with dull intentness at the priest. "Why not?" asked the priest with good-humoured surprise. "Because it's a dragon," muttered Grigory. "A dragon? What dragon?" Grigory did not speak for some time. "It's a confusion of nature," he muttered vaguely, but firmly, and obviously unwilling to say more. They laughed, and of course christened the poor baby. Grigory prayed earnestly at the font, but his opinion of the newborn child remained unchanged. Yet he did not interfere in any way. As long as the sickly infant lived, he scarcely looked at it, tried indeed not to notice it, and for the most part kept out of the cottage. But when, at the end of a fortnight, the baby died of thrush, he himself laid the child in its little coffin, looked at it in profound grief, and when they were filling up the shallow little grave, he fell on his knees and bowed down to the earth. He did not for years afterwards mention his child, nor did Marfa speak of the baby before him, and, even if Grigory were not present, she never spoke of it above a whisper. Marfa observed that, from the day of the burial, he devoted himself to religion and took to reading The Lives of the Saints, for the most part sitting alone and in silence, and always putting on his big, round, silver-rimmed spectacles. He rarely read aloud, only perhaps in Lent. He was fond of the Book of Job, and had somehow got hold of a copy of the sayings and sermons of the God-fearing Father Isaac the Syrian, which he read persistently for years together, understanding very little of it, but perhaps prizing and loving it the more for that. Of late he had begun to listen to the doctrines of the sect of flagellants settled in the neighbourhood. He was evidently shaken by them, but judged it unfitting to go over to the new faith. His habit of theological reading gave him an expression of still greater gravity. He was perhaps predisposed to mysticism, and the birth of his deformed child, and its death, had, as though by special design, been accompanied by another strange and marvellous event, which, as he said later, had left a stamp upon his soul. It happened that on the very night after the burial of his child, Marfa was awakened by the wail of a newborn baby. She was frightened and waked her husband. He listened and said he thought it was more like someone groaning. It might be a woman. He got up and dressed. It was a rather warm night in May. As he went down the steps, he distinctly heard groans coming from the garden. But the gate from the yard into the garden was locked at night, and there was no other way of entering it, for it was enclosed all round by a strong, high fence. Going back into the house, Grigory lighted a lantern, took the garden key, and taking no notice of the hysterical fears of his wife, who was still persuaded that she heard a child crying, and that it was her own baby crying and calling for her, went into the garden in silence. There he heard at once that the groans came from the bathhouse that stood near the garden gate, and that they were groans of a woman. Opening the door of the bathhouse, he saw a sight which petrified him. An idiot girl who wandered about the streets and was known to the whole town by the nickname of Lizaveta Smerdyatskaya, Stinking Lizaveta, had got into the bathhouse and had just given birth to a child. She lay dying with the baby beside her. She said nothing, for she'd never been able to speak. But her story needs a chapter to itself. Chapter 2. Lizaveta. There was one circumstance which struck Grigory particularly and confirmed a very unpleasant and revolting suspicion. This Lizaveta was a dwarfish creature, not 5 foot within a wee bit, as many of the pious old women said pathetically about her after her death. Her broad, healthy, red face had a look of blank idiocy, and the fixed stare in her eyes was unpleasant, in spite of their meek expression. She wandered about, summer and winter alike, barefooted, wearing nothing but a hempen smock. Her coarse, almost black hair curled like lamb's wool, and formed a sort of huge cap on her head. It was always crusted with mud, and had leaves, bits of stick, and shavings clinging to it, as she always slept on the ground and in the dirt. Her father, a homeless, sickly drunkard called Ilya, had lost everything and lived many years as a workman with some well-to-do tradespeople. Her mother had long been dead. Spiteful and diseased, Ilya used to beat Lizaveta inhumanly whenever she returned to him. But she rarely did so, for everyone in the town was ready to look after her as being an idiot, and so specially dear to God. Ilya's employers and many others in the town, especially of the tradespeople, tried to clothe her better, and always rigged her out with high boots and a sheepskin coat for the winter. But although she allowed them to dress her up without resisting, she usually went away, preferably to the cathedral porch, and taking off all that had been given her, kerchief, sheepskin, skirt, or boots, she left them there and walked away barefoot in her smock as before. It happened on one occasion that a new governor of the province, making a tour of inspection in our town, saw Lizaveta, and was wounded in his tenderest susceptibilities. And though he was told she was an idiot, he pronounced that for a young woman of 20 to wander about in nothing but a smock was a breach of the proprieties and must not occur again. But the governor went his way, and Lizaveta was left as she was. At last her father died, which made her even more acceptable in the eyes of the religious persons of the town, as an orphan. In fact, everyone seemed to like her. Even the boys did not tease her, and the boys of our town, especially the schoolboys, are a mischievous set. She would walk into strange houses, and no one drove her away. Everyone was kind to her, and gave her something. If she were given a copper, she would take it, and at once drop it in the alms jug of the church or prison. If she were given a roll or bun in the market, she would hand it to the first child she met. Sometimes she would stop one of the richest ladies in the town and give it to her, and the lady would be pleased to take it. She herself never tasted anything but black bread and water. If she went into an expensive shop, where there were costly goods or money lying about, no one kept watch on her, for they knew that if she saw thousands of roubles overlooked by them, she would not have touched a farthing. She scarcely ever went to church. She slept either in the church porch or climbed over a hurdle. There are many hurdles instead of fences to this day in our town. Into a kitchen garden. She used at least once a week to turn up at home. That is, at the house of her father's former employers, and in the winter went there every night, and slept either in the passage or the cow-house. People were amazed that she could stand such a life, but she was accustomed to it, and although she was so tiny, she was of a robust constitution. Some of the townspeople declared that she did all this only from pride, but that is hardly credible. She could hardly speak, and only from time to time uttered an inarticulate grunt. How could she have been proud? It happened one clear, warm, moonlight night in September, many years ago. Five or six drunken revellers were returning from the club at a very late hour, according to our provincial notions. They passed through the back way, which led between the back gardens of the houses, with hurdles on either side. This way leads out onto the bridge over the long, stinking pool which we were accustomed to call a river. Among the nettles and burdocks under the hurdle, our revellers saw Lizaveta asleep. They stopped to look at her laughing, and began jesting with unbridled licentiousness. It occurred to one young gentleman to make the whimsical inquiry whether anyone could possibly look upon such an animal as a woman, and so forth. They all pronounced with lofty repugnance that it was impossible. But Fyodor Pavlovich, who was among them, sprang forward and declared that it was by no means impossible, and that, indeed, there was a certain piquancy about it, and so on. It is true that at that time he was overdoing his part as a buffoon. He liked to put himself forward and entertain the company, ostensibly on equal terms, of course, though in reality he was on a servile footing with them. It was just at the time when he had received the news of his first wife's death in Petersburg, and with crape upon his hat, was drinking and behaving so shamelessly, that even the most reckless among us was shocked at the sight of him. The revellers, of course, laughed at this unexpected opinion, and one of them even began challenging him to act upon it. The others repelled the idea even more emphatically, although still with the utmost hilarity, and at last they went on their way. Later on, Fyodor Pavlovich swore that he had gone with them, and perhaps it was so, no one knows for certain, and no one ever knew. But 5 or 6 months later, all the town was talking, with intense and sincere indignation, of Lizaveta's condition, and trying to find out who was the miscreant who had wronged her. Then suddenly a terrible rumour was all over the town that this miscreant was no other than Fyodor Pavlovich. Who set the rumour going? Of that drunken band, 5 had left the town, and the only one still among us was an elderly and much-respected civil councillor, the father of grown-up daughters, who could hardly have spread the tale, even if there had been any foundation for it. But rumour pointed straight at Fyodor Pavlovich, and persisted in pointing at him. Of course, this was no great grievance to him. He would not have troubled to contradict a set of tradespeople. In those days he was proud, and did not condescend to talk, except in his own circle of the officials and nobles, whom he entertained so well. At the time, Grigory stood up for his master vigorously. He provoked quarrels and altercations in defence of him, and succeeded in bringing some people around to his side. "It's the wench's own fault," he asserted, and the culprit was Karp, a dangerous convict, who had escaped from prison and whose name was well known to us, as he had hidden in our town. This conjecture sounded plausible, for it was remembered that Karp had been in the neighbourhood just at that time, in the autumn, and had robbed 3 people. But this affair and all the talk about it did not estrange popular sympathy from the poor idiot. She was better looked after than ever. A well-to-do merchant's widow named Kondratyev arranged to take her into her house at the end of April, meaning not to let her go out until after the confinement. They kept a constant watch over her, but in spite of their vigilance she escaped on the very last day, and made her way into Fyodor Pavlovich's garden. How, in her condition, she managed to climb over the high, strong fence remained a mystery. Some maintained that she must have been lifted over by somebody. Others hinted at something more uncanny. The most likely explanation is that it happened naturally, that Lizaveta, accustomed to clambering over hurdles to sleep in gardens, had somehow managed to climb this fence, in spite of her condition, and had leapt down, injuring herself. Grigory rushed to Marfa and sent her to Lizaveta, while he ran to fetch an old midwife who lived close by. They saved the baby, but Lizaveta died at dawn. Grigory took the baby, brought it home, and making his wife sit down, put it on her lap. "A child of God, an orphan, is akin to all," he said, "and to us above others. Our little lost one has sent us this, who has come from the devil's son and a holy innocent. Nurse him and weep no more." So Marfa brought up the child. He was christened Pavel, to which people were not slow in adding Fyodorovich, son of Fyodor. Fyodor Pavlovich did not object to any of this, and thought it amusing, though he persisted vigorously in denying his responsibility. The townspeople were pleased at his adopting the foundling. Later on, Fyodor Pavlovich invented a surname for the child, calling him Smerdyakov, after his mother's nickname. So, this Smerdyakov became Fyodor Pavlovich's second servant, and was living in the lodge with Grigory and Marfa at the time our story begins. He was employed as cook. I ought to say something of this Smerdyakov, but I'm ashamed of keeping my reader's attention so long occupied with these common menials, and I will go back to my story, hoping to say more of Smerdyakov in the course of it. Chapter 3. The Confession of a Passionate Heart, in verse. Alyosha remained for some time irresolute after hearing the command his father shouted to him from the carriage. But in spite of his uneasiness, he did not stand still. That was not his way. He went at once to the kitchen to find out what his father had been doing above. Then he set off, trusting that on the way he would find some answer to the doubt tormenting him. I hasten to add that his father's shouts, commanding him to return home with his mattress and pillow, did not frighten him in the least. He understood perfectly that those peremptory shouts were merely a flourish to produce an effect. In the same way, a tradesman in our town who was celebrating his name day with a party of friends, getting angry at being refused more vodka, smashed up his own crockery and furniture, and tore his own and his wife's clothes, and finally broke his windows, all for the sake of effect. Next day, of course, when he was sober, he regretted the broken cups and saucers. Alyosha knew that his father would let him go back to the monastery next day, possibly even that evening. Moreover, he was fully persuaded that his father might hurt anyone else, but would not hurt him. Alyosha was certain that no one in the whole world ever would want to hurt him, and what is more, he knew that no one could hurt him. This was for him an axiom, assumed once for all without question, and he went his way without hesitation, relying on it. But at that moment, an anxiety of a different sort disturbed him, and worried him the more because he could not formulate it. It was the fear of a woman, of Katerina Ivanovna, who had so urgently entreated him in the note handed to him by Madame Holokov, to come and see her about something. This request, and the necessity of going, had at once aroused an uneasy feeling in his heart, and this feeling had grown more and more painful all the morning, in spite of the scenes at the hermitage, and at the Father Superior's. He was not uneasy because he did not know what she would speak of, and what he must answer. And he was not afraid of her simply as a woman, though he knew little of women. He had spent his life, from early childhood till he entered the monastery, entirely with women. He was afraid of that woman, Katerina Ivanovna. He had been afraid of her from the first time he saw her. He had only seen her two or three times, and had only chanced to say a few words to her. He thought of her as a beautiful, proud, imperious girl. It was not her beauty which troubled him, but something else, and the vagueness of his apprehension increased the apprehension itself. The girl's aims were of the noblest, he knew that. She was trying to save his brother Dmitri simply through generosity, though he had already behaved badly to her. Yet, although Alyosha recognized and did justice to all these fine and generous sentiments, a shiver began to run down his back as soon as he drew near her house. He reflected that he would not find Ivan, who was so intimate a friend, with her, for Ivan was certainly now with his father. Dmitri he was even more certain not to find there, and he had a foreboding of the reason. And so his conversation would be with her alone. He had a great longing to run and see his brother Dmitri before that fateful interview. Without showing them the letter, he could talk to him about it. But Dmitri lived a long way off, and he was sure to be away from home, too. Standing still for a minute, he reached a final decision. Crossing himself with a rapid and accustomed gesture, and at once smiling, he turned resolutely in the direction of his terrible lady. He knew her house, if he went by the high street and then across the marketplace. It was a long way round. Though our town is small, it is scattered, and the houses are far apart. And meanwhile his father was expecting him, and perhaps had not yet forgotten his command. He might be unreasonable, and so he had to make haste to get there and back. So he decided to take a short cut by the back way, for he knew every inch of the ground. This meant skirting fences, climbing over hurdles, and crossing other people's backyards, where everyone he met knew him and greeted him. In this way he could reach the high street in half the time. He had to pass the garden adjoining his father's, and belonging to a little tumble-down house with four windows. The owner of this house, as Alyosha knew, was a bedridden old woman living with her daughter, who had been a genteel maidservant in generals' families in Petersburg. Now she had been at home a year, looking after her sick mother. She always dressed up in fine clothes, though her old mother and she had sunk into such poverty that they went every day to Fyodor Pavlovich's kitchen for soup and bread, which Marfa gave readily. Yet, though the young woman came up for soup, she'd never sold any of her dresses, and one of these even had a long train, a fact which Alyosha had learned from Rakitin, who always knew everything that was going on in the town. He had forgotten it as soon as he heard it, but now, on reaching the garden, he remembered the dress with the train, raised his head, which had been bowed in thought, and came upon something quite unexpected. Over the hurdle in the garden, Dmitri, mounted on something, was leaning forward, gesticulating violently, beckoning to him, obviously afraid to utter a word for fear of being overheard. Alyosha ran up to the hurdle.
"It's a good thing you looked up. I was nearly shouting to you,"
Mitya said in a joyful, hurried whisper.
"Climb in here quickly. How splendid that you've come. I was just thinking of you."
Alyosha was delighted too, but he did not know how to get over the hurdle. Mitya put his powerful hand under his elbow to help him jump. Tucking up his cassock, Alyosha leapt over the hurdle with the agility of a bare-legged street urchin.
"Well done, now come along,"
said Mitya, in an enthusiastic whisper.
"Where?"
whispered Alyosha, looking about him and finding himself in a deserted garden with no one near but themselves. The garden was small, but the house was at least 50 paces away.
"There's no one here. Why do you whisper?" asked Alyosha.
"Why do I whisper? Deuce take it!"
cried Dmitri at the top of his voice.
"You see what silly tricks nature plays when I'm here in secret and on the watch. I'll explain later on, but knowing it's a secret, I began whispering like a fool when there's no need. Let's go over there. Till then, be quiet. I want to kiss you. Glory to God in the world, glory to God in me. I was just repeating that sitting here before you came."
The garden was about 3 acres in extent, and planted with trees only along the fence at the four sides. There were apple trees, maples, limes, and birch trees. The middle of the garden was an empty grass space, from which several hundredweight of hay was carried in the summer. The garden was let out for a few roubles for the summer. There were also plantations of raspberries and currants and gooseberries laid out along the sides. A kitchen garden had been planted lately near the house. Dmitri led his brother to the most secluded corner of the garden. There, in a thicket of lime trees and old bushes of black currant, elder, snowball tree, and lilac, there stood a tumble-down green summer house, blackened with age. Its walls were of lattice work, but there was still a roof which could give shelter. God knows when this summer house was built. There was a tradition that it had been put up some 50 years before by a retired colonel called von Schmidt, who owned the house at that time. It was all in decay, the floor was rotting, the planks were loose, the woodwork smelled musty. In the summer-house there was a green wooden table fixed in the ground, and round it were some green benches upon which it was still possible to sit. Alyosha had at once observed his brother's exhilarated condition, and on entering the arbour he saw half a bottle of brandy and a wine-glass on the table.
"That's brandy," Mitya laughed. "I see your look. He's drinking again. Distrust the apparition. Distrust the worthless lying crowd, and lay aside thy doubts. I'm not drinking, I'm only indulging, as that pig, your Rakitin, says. He'll be a civil councillor one day, but he'll always talk about indulging. Sit down. I could take you in my arms, Alyosha, and press you to my bosom till I crush you, for in the whole world, in reality, can you take it in? I love no one but you."
He uttered the last words in a sort of exultation.
"No one but you and one jade I've fallen in love with, to my ruin. But being in love doesn't mean loving. You may be in love with a woman and yet hate her. Remember that. I can talk about it gaily still. Sit down here by the table and I'll sit beside you and look at you and go on talking. You shall keep quiet and I'll go on talking, for the time has come. But on reflection, you know, I'd better speak quietly, for here, you can never tell what ears are listening. I will explain everything, as they say. The story will be continued. Why have I been longing for you? Why have I been thirsting for you all these days and just now? It's 5 days since I've cast anchor here. Because it's only to you that I can tell everything. Because I must, because I need you, because tomorrow I shall fly from the clouds, because tomorrow life is ending and beginning. Have you ever felt, have you ever dreamt of falling down a precipice into a pit? That's just how I'm falling, but not in a dream, and I'm not afraid. And don't you be afraid. At least I am afraid, but I enjoy it. It's not enjoyment, though, but ecstasy. Damn it all, whatever it is. A strong spirit, a weak spirit, a womanish spirit, whatever it is. Let us praise nature. You see what sunshine, how clear the sky is. The leaves are all green. It's still summer. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and the stillness. Where were you going?
I was going to Father's, but I meant to go to Katerina Ivanovna's first.
To her and to Father? Ooh, what a coincidence. Why was I waiting for you, hungering and thirsting for you in every cranny of my soul and even in my ribs? Why, to send you to Father and to her, Katerina Ivanovna. So as to have done with her and with Father. To send an angel. I might have sent anyone, but I wanted to send an angel, and here you are on your way to see Father and her.
Did you really mean to send me? Cried Alyosha with a distressed expression.
Stay, you knew it, and I see you understand it all at once. But be quiet for a moment. Don't be sorry and don't cry.
Dmitri stood up, thought a moment, and put his finger to his forehead.
She's asked you. Written to you a letter or something. That's why you're going to her? You wouldn't be going except for that.
Here is her note.
Alyosha took it out of his pocket. Mitya looked through it quickly.
And you were going the back way? Oh, gods, I thank you for sending him by the back way, and he came to me like the golden fish to the silly old fishermen in the fable. Listen, Alyosha, listen, brother. Now, I mean to tell you everything, for I must tell someone. An angel in heaven I've told already, but I want to tell an angel on earth. You are an angel on earth. You will hear and judge and forgive, and that's what I need, that someone above me should forgive. Listen. If 2 people break away from everything on earth and fly off into the unknown, or at least one of them, and before flying off or going to ruin he comes to someone else and says, "Do this for me," some favour never asked before that could only be asked on one's deathbed, would that other refuse if he were a friend or a brother?
I will do it, but tell me what it is and make haste, said Alyosha.
Make haste. Don't be in a hurry, Alyosha. You hurry and worry yourself. There's no need to hurry now. Now the world has taken a new turning. Ah, Alyosha, what a pity you can't understand ecstasy. But what am I saying to him, as though you didn't understand it? What an ass I am. What am I saying? Be noble, O man. Who says that?
Alyosha made up his mind to wait. He felt that perhaps indeed his work lay here. Mitya sank into thought for a moment, with his elbow on the table and his head in his hand. Both were silent.
"Alyosha," said Mitya, "you're the only one who won't laugh. I should like to begin, my confession, with Schiller's Hymn to Joy, and Die Freude. I don't know German, I only know it's called that. Don't think I'm talking nonsense because I'm drunk. I'm not a bit drunk. Brandy's all very well, but I need 2 bottles to make me drunk. Silenus with his rosy fizz upon his stumbling ass. But I've not drunk a quarter of a bottle, and I'm not Silenus. I'm not Silenus, though I am strong.
That is in Russian, Silen.
For I've made a decision once for all. Forgive me the pun. You'll have to forgive me a lot more than puns today. Don't be uneasy. I'm not spitting it out. I'm talking sense, and I'll come to the point in a minute. I won't keep you in suspense. Stay. How does it go?
He raised his head, thought a minute, and began with enthusiasm.
Wild and fearful in his cavern hid the naked troglodyte, and the homeless nomad wandered, laying waste the fertile plain, menacing with spear and arrow. In the woods the hunter strayed,
Woe to all poor wretches stranded on those cruel and hostile shores. From the peak of high Olympus came the mother Ceres down, seeking in those savage regions her lost daughter Proserpine, but the goddess found no refuge, found no kindly welcome there, and no temple bearing witness to the worship of the gods. From the fields and from the vineyards came no fruits to deck the feasts, only flesh of blood-stained victims smouldered on the altar fires. And where'er the grieving goddess turns her melancholy gaze, sunk in vilest degradation, man his loathsomeness displays.
Mitya broke into sobs and seized Alyosha's hand.
My dear, in degradation now, too, there's a terrible amount of suffering for man on earth, a terrible lot of trouble. And don't think I'm only a brute in an officer's uniform wallowing in dirt and drink. I hardly think of anything but that degraded man. If only I'm not lying. I pray God I'm not lying and showing off. I think about that man because I am that man myself. Would he purge his soul from vileness and attain to light and worth, he must turn and cling forever to his ancient Mother Earth. But the difficulty is, how am I to cling forever to Mother Earth? I don't kiss her. I don't cleave her bosom. Am I to become a peasant or a shepherd? I go on. I don't know whether I'm going to shame or to light and joy. That's the trouble, for everything in this world is a riddle. And whenever I've happened to sink into the vilest degradation, and it's always been happening, I always read that poem about Ceres and man. Has it reformed me? Never. For I'm a Karamazov. When I do leap into the pit, I go headlong with my heels up and am pleased to be falling in that degrading attitude and pride myself upon it. And in the very depths of that degradation, I begin a hymn of praise. Let me be accursed. Let me be vile and base. Only let me kiss the hem of the veil in which my God is shrouded. Though I may be following the devil, I am thy son, O Lord, and I love thee, and I feel the joy without which the world cannot stand. Joy everlasting fostereth the soul of all creation. It is her secret ferment fires the cup of life with flame. 'Tis at her beck the grass hath turned each blade towards the light, and solar systems have evolved from chaos and dark night, filling the realms of boundless space beyond the sage's sight. At bounteous nature's kindly breast, all things that breathe drink joy, and birds and beasts and creeping things all follow where she leads. Her gifts to man are friends in need, the wreath, the foaming must, to angels, vision of God's throne, to insects, sensual lust. But enough poetry, I'm in tears, let me cry. It may be foolishness that everyone would laugh at, but you won't laugh, your eyes are shining too. Enough poetry, I want to tell you now about the insects to whom God gave sensual lust. To insects, sensual lust. I am that insect, brother, and it is said of me especially. All we Karamazovs are such insects. And, angel as you are, that insect lives in you too and will stir up a tempest in your blood. Tempest, because sensual lust is a tempest, worse than a tempest. Beauty is a terrible and awful thing. It is terrible because it has not been fathomed and never can be fathomed, for God sets us nothing but riddles. Here the boundaries meet, and all contradictions exist side by side. I'm not a cultivated man, brother, but I've thought a lot about this. It's terrible what mysteries there are. Too many riddles weigh men down on earth. We must solve them as we can and try to keep a dry skin in the water. Beauty. I can't endure the thought that a man of lofty mind and heart begins with the ideal of the Madonna and ends with the ideal of Sodom. What's still more awful is that a man with the ideal of Sodom in his soul does not renounce the ideal of the Madonna, and his heart may be on fire with that ideal, genuine and on fire, just as in his days of youth and innocence. Yes, man is broad, too broad indeed. I'd have him narrow up. The devil only knows what to make of it. What to the mind is shameful is beauty and nothing else to the heart. Is there beauty in Sodom? Believe me that for the immense mass of mankind, beauty is found in Sodom. Did you know that secret? The awful thing is that beauty is mysterious as well as terrible. God and the devil are fighting there, and the battlefield is the heart of man. But a man always talks of his own ache. Listen, now to come to facts. Chapter 4. The Confession of a Passionate Heart, in anecdote. I was leading a wild life then. Father said just now that I spent several thousand rubles in seducing young girls. That's a swinish invention, and there was nothing of the sort. And if there was, I didn't need money simply for that. With me, money is an accessory, the overflow of my heart, the framework. Today she would be my lady, tomorrow a wench out of the streets in her place. I entertain them both. I threw away money by the handful on music, rioting, and gypsies. Sometimes I gave it to the ladies, too, for they'll take it greedily, that must be admitted, and be pleased and thankful for it. Ladies used to be fond of me. Not all of them, but it happened. It happened. But I always liked side paths, little dark back alleys behind the main road. There one finds adventures and surprises, and precious metal in the dirt. I'm speaking figuratively, brother. In the town I was in, there were no such back alleys in the literal sense, but morally there were. If you were like me, you'd know what that means. I loved vice. I loved the ignominy of vice. I loved cruelty. Am I not a bug? Am I not a noxious insect? In fact, a Karamazov. Once we went, a whole lot of us, for a picnic in seven sledges. It was dark, it was winter, and I began squeezing a girl's hand, forced her to kiss me. She was the daughter of an official, a sweet, gentle, submissive creature. She allowed me. She allowed me much, in the dark. She thought, poor thing, that I should come next day to make her an offer. I was looked upon as a good match, too. But I didn't say a word to her for 5 months. I used to see her in a corner at dances. We were always having dances. Her eyes watching me. I saw how they glowed with fire. A fire of gentle indignation. This game only tickled that insect lust I cherished in my soul. 5 months later she married an official and left the town, still angry and still perhaps in love with me. Now they live happily. Observe that I told no one. I didn't boast of it. I'm full of low desires, and love what's low. I'm not dishonourable. You're blushing. Your eyes flashed. Enough of this filth with you. And all this was nothing much. Wayside blossoms a la Paul de Kock. Though the cruel insect had already grown strong in my soul. I've a perfect album of reminiscences, brother. God bless them, the darlings. I tried to break it off without quarrelling, and I never gave them away. I never bragged of one of them, but that's enough. You can't suppose I brought you here simply to talk of such nonsense. Now, I'm going to tell you something more curious, and don't be surprised that I'm glad to tell you instead of being ashamed.
You say that because I blushed, Alyosha said suddenly. I wasn't blushing at what you were saying or at what you've done. I blushed because I'm the same as you are.
You? Come, that's going a little too far.
No, it's not too far, said Alyosha warmly. Obviously the idea was not a new one. The ladder's the same. I'm at the bottom step and you're above. Somewhere about the 13th, that's how I see it. But it's all the same, absolutely the same in kind. Anyone on the bottom step is bound to go up to the top one.
Then one ought not to step on at all.
Anyone who can help it had better not.
But can you?
I think not.
Hush, Alyosha, hush, darling. I could kiss your hand, you touch me so. That rogue, Grushenka, has an eye for men. She told me once that she'd devour you one day. There, I won't. From this field of corruption fouled by flies, let's pass to my tragedy. Also befouled by flies, that is, by every sort of vileness. Although the old man told lies about my seducing innocence, there really was something of the sort in my tragedy. Though it was only once, and then it did not come off. The old man who has reproached me with what never happened does not even know of this fact. I never told anyone about it. You're the first, except Ivan, of course. Ivan knows everything. He knew about it long before you, but Ivan's a tomb.
Ivan's a tomb?
Yes.
Alyosha listened with great attention.
I was lieutenant in a line regiment, but still I was under supervision like a kind of convict. Yet I was awfully well received in the little town. I spent money right and left. I was thought to be rich. I thought so myself. But I must have pleased them in other ways as well. Although they shook their heads over me, they liked me. My colonel, who was an old man, took a sudden dislike to me. He was always down upon me. But I had powerful friends, and, moreover, all the town was on my side, so he couldn't do me much harm. I was in fault myself for refusing to treat him with proper respect. I was proud. This obstinate fellow was really a very good sort, kind-hearted and hospitable, and had two wives, both dead. His first wife, who was of a humble family, left a daughter as unpretentious as herself. She was a young woman of 24 when I was there, and was living with her father and an aunt, her mother's sister. The aunt was simple and illiterate. The niece was simple but lively. I like to say nice things about people. I never knew a woman of more charming character than Agafya. Fancy, her name was Agafya Ivanovna. And she wasn't bad-looking either, in the Russian style. Tall, stout, with a full figure and beautiful eyes, though a rather coarse face. She had not married, although she had had two suitors. She refused them, but was as cheerful as ever. I was intimate with her, and not in that way. It was pure friendship. I've often been friendly with women, quite innocently. I used to talk to her with shocking frankness, and she only laughed. Many women like such freedom, and she was a girl, too, which made it very amusing. Another thing, one could never think of her as a young lady. She and her aunt lived in her father's house with a sort of voluntary humility, not putting themselves on an equality with other people. She was a general favourite, and of use to everyone, for she was a clever dressmaker. She had a talent for it. She gave her services freely without asking for payment, but if anyone offered her payment, she didn't refuse. The colonel, of course, was a very different matter. He was one of the chief personages in the district. He kept open house, entertained the whole town, gave suppers and dances. At the time I arrived and joined the battalion, all the town was talking of the expected return of the colonel's second daughter, a great beauty who had just left a fashionable school in the capital. This second daughter is Katerina Ivanovna, and she was the child of the second wife, who belonged to a distinguished general's family. Although, as I learnt on good authority, she too brought the colonel no money. She had connections, and that was all. There may have been expectations, but they'd come to nothing. Yet, when the young lady came from boarding school on a visit, the whole town revived. Our most distinguished ladies, two excellencies and a colonel's wife, and all the rest, following their lead, at once took her up and gave entertainments in her honour. She was the belle of the balls and picnics, and they got up tableaux vivants in aid of distressed governesses. I took no notice. I went on as wildly as before, and one of my exploits at the time set all the town talking. I saw her eyes taking my measure one evening at the battery commander's, but I didn't go up to her, as though I disdained her acquaintance. I did go up and speak to her at an evening party not long after. She scarcely looked at me and compressed her lips scornfully. "Wait a bit, I'll have my revenge," thought I. I behaved like an awful fool on many occasions at that time, and I was conscious of it myself. What made it worse was that I felt that Katenka was not an innocent boarding school miss, but a person of character, proud, and really high principled. Above all, she had education and intellect, and I had neither. You think I meant to make her an offer? No, I simply wanted to revenge myself because I was such a hero and she didn't seem to feel it. Meanwhile, I spent my time in drink and riot, till the lieutenant colonel put me under arrest for 3 days. Just at that time, father sent me 6,000 rubles in return for my sending him a deed, giving up all claims upon him, settling our accounts, so to speak, and saying that I wouldn't expect anything more. I didn't understand a word of it at the time, until I came here, Alyosha, till the last few days, indeed, perhaps even now. I haven't been able to make head or tail of my money affairs with father, but never mind that, we'll talk of it later. Just as I received the money, I got a letter from a friend telling me something that interested me immensely. The authorities, I learned, were dissatisfied with our lieutenant colonel.
He was suspected of irregularities. In fact, his enemies were preparing a surprise for him. And then the commander of the division arrived and kicked up the devil of a shindy. Shortly afterwards he was ordered to retire. I won't tell you how it all happened. He had enemies, certainly. Suddenly there was a marked coolness in the town towards him and all his family. His friends all turned their backs on him. Then I took my first step. I met Agafya Ivanovna, with whom I'd always kept up a friendship, and said, "Do you know there's a deficit of 4,500 rubles of government money in your father's accounts?" "What do you mean? What makes you say so? The general was here not long ago, and everything was all right." "Then it was, but now it isn't." She was terribly scared. "Don't frighten me," she said. "Who told you so?" "Don't be uneasy," I said. "I won't tell anyone. You know I'm as silent as a tomb. I only wanted, in view of possibilities, to add that when they demand that 4,500 rubles from your father and he can't produce it, he'll be tried and made to serve as a common soldier in his old age, unless you like to send me your young lady secretly. I've just had money paid me. I'll give her 4,000, if you like, and keep the secret religiously." "Ah, you scoundrel," that's what she said. "You wicked scoundrel, how dare you?" She went away furiously indignant, while I shouted after her once more that the secret should be kept sacred. Those two simple creatures, Agafya and her aunt, I may as well say at once, behaved like perfect angels all through this business. They genuinely adored their Katya, thought her far above them, and waited on her hand and foot. But Agafya told her of our conversation. I found that out afterwards. She didn't keep it back, and of course that was all I wanted. Suddenly the new major arrived to take command of the battalion. The old lieutenant colonel was taken ill at once, couldn't leave his room for 2 days, and didn't hand over the government money. Dr. Kravchenko declared that he really was ill, but I knew for a fact, and had known for a long time, that for the last 4 years the money had never been in his hands, except when the commander made his visits of inspection. He used to lend it to a trustworthy person, a merchant of our town called Trifonov, an old widower with a big beard and gold-rimmed spectacles. He used to go to the fair, do a profitable business with the money, and return the whole sum to the colonel, bringing with it a present from the fair, as well as interest on the loan. But this time, I heard all about it quite by chance from Trifonov's son and heir, a drivelling youth and one of the most vicious in the world. This time, I say, Trifonov brought nothing back from the fair. The lieutenant colonel flew to him. "I've never received any money from you and couldn't possibly have received any." That was all the answer he got. So now our lieutenant colonel is confined to the house with a towel round his head, while they're all three busy putting ice on it. All at once an orderly arrives on the scene with the book and the order to hand over the battalion money immediately within 2 hours. He signed the book. I saw the signature in the book afterwards, stood up, saying he would put on his uniform, ran to his bedroom, loaded his double-barreled gun with a service bullet, took the boot off his right foot, fixed the gun against his chest, and began feeling for the trigger with his foot. But Agafya, remembering what I'd told her, had her suspicions. She stole up and peeped into the room, just in time. She rushed in, flung herself upon him from behind, threw her arms round him, and the gun went off, hit the ceiling, but hurt no one. The others ran in, took away the gun, and held him by the arms. I heard all about this afterwards. I was at home, it was getting dusk, and I was just preparing to go out. I dressed, brushed my hair, scented my handkerchief, and taken up my cap. When suddenly the door opened, and facing me in the room stood Katerina Ivanovna. It was strange how things happen sometimes. No one had seen her in the street, so that no one knew of it in the town. I lodged with two decrepit old ladies who looked after me. They were most obliging old things, ready to do anything for me, and at my request were as silent afterwards as two cast-iron posts. Of course, I grasped the position at once. She walked in and looked straight at me, her dark eyes determined, even defiant. But on her lips and round her mouth I saw uncertainty. "My sister told me," she began, "that you would give me 4,000 rubles if I came to you for it myself. I have come Give me the money. She couldn't keep it up. She was breathless, frightened. Her voice failed her in the corners of her mouth, and the lines round it quivered. Alyosha, are you listening, or are you asleep?